Welcome to the next episode of The Break Breakdown, a podcast from Queensbird Films. I'm Courtney Romano, your host, and The Break Breakdown is a podcast that investigates what it means to get your big break. And, you know, when we use the term big break, that always sounds elusive to me, you know, as if it comes from outside of ourselves. Someone needs to give you your big break. And sure, that happens. You know, you might get recognition or a certain amount of prestige given to you from an outside source. You can get a great write-up in the Times. You can get something produced, even. But the closer that we look at the film industry, and for that matter, all of the artistic industries that we're talking about on this podcast, theater, music, comedy, everything, the more we see that a big break is kind of just something that's sort of made up. You know, everyone's just making it up. And that begs the question, if a big break doesn't necessarily have to come from outside, or if the outside is just kind of arbitrarily making things up and arbitrarily picking people on which to bestow said big break, then can we just give ourselves the big break we've been waiting for? I happen to think the answer is yes, but I've been proved wrong in my life. So that's what this podcast is all about, investigating all of that and trying to find out if my hunch is correct and if it's something that we can give ourselves. So I've been talking to some amazing people on this podcast, you know, people who are doing legit things, people with organizations that are enacting social change within their artistic industry, people who are creating chart-topping singles in genres that would not necessarily be accepting them. People who are creating space and creating work that is truly for the people and for the voice of the people, and not just for the voice of perhaps one singular brand or one singular idea that we've seen done over and over again. And so this podcast, The Break Breakdown, is not necessarily just about my voice. I think my voice is kind of a baseline, like here we are, we're back at The Break Breakdown, but it's really a foundation so that we can amplify everyone's voice, amplify the people who are coming on, amplify the other artists in the space, because I truly believe, and I want to practice what I preach, that it is a community effort. What is a community effort? Life. Like, life is a community effort. I believe in working hard. I believe in being your, you know, your own toughest competitor, trying to up-level, trying to do better. That's what I'm trying to do with every one of these episodes. I listen back and I think, all right, what could have I done better less, you know, this time than last time? What better question was there? What better introduction was there? What better sound quality? Like, how can I do better? But none of that is worth anything, I think, if we're not also looking at our community as a whole and not taking away from that community, but uplifting that community, amplifying that community, and saying, no, I refuse to compete where I don't need to compete. I instead say that I stand with my friends and my colleagues and the people that I admire, the people who inspire and influence me, even if they're in the same industry, doing the same exact thing, there is space for all of us. So I hope that The Break Breakdown is a place where we can amplify all kinds of people and really say, no, we belong in community with each other. And this is just one place that we can find that community. So if you've been following along and there's an episode that you have really loved with an amazing independent artist, please follow them, tag them, pre-save their albums on Spotify when they're, you know, getting ready to be released. You know, donate to their campaigns. Just tell your friends and family about them. Let's help everyone who comes into this communal space that we are building together be seen and shared, and you know, get them out into the world, because at the end of the day, we want to reinforce each other. The farther we go together, the farther we're going to go collectively. And I think if you're listening to this right now, my guess is that you feel that same way. So let's lean into that and let's build that community. Quick note about Queensbird Films. I'm really pumped that the short film we made last year in 2020, Screen Test, is going to be at the Queens World Film Festival next month, and also the New York Flash Film Festival. It's a finalist in that second film festival. I'm really excited about the Queens World Film Festival because we just found out, literally just got the email a couple hours ago, that it is going to be at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, which is Craig and my favorite museum in all of New York City, I think. I mean, it's got to be top three. I do love MoMA. Met has a special place in my heart because I catered there, so I know all the back rooms and back alleyways. But MoMA, Museum of the Moving Image, is just amazing. And to know that our film Screen Test is going to be part of the festival that's happening there is just like, it just makes me feel, you know, it just makes me feel like I'm home. And that's all we really want at the end of the day, right? So I'm really excited about that. We're already working on our next project, which is an 8-episode series. It's a dark comedy about anxiety, and I promise it's fun. there's a lot of stuff going on, is basically what I'm trying to say. So sign up for our newsletter. The link is in the show notes. And essentially, I'm only ever emailing about once a month. Sometimes it's 5 weeks if I'm just having a really sleepless week with my daughter. And it's a roundup of our podcast episodes from the last month, a little anecdote, any news about Screen Test. And pretty soon, there's also going to be news on our latest production, where we are with that, casting calls, and all kinds of ways to get involved and interesting things to find out about. So sign up for that in newsletter if you haven't already. I am so excited to share this conversation with you today. I was talking with Tia DeShazor, who is a lyricist, librettist. She founded BOLD, which is an organization building up Black women in the performing arts for the restoration of culture. She's also a creative coach, where her mission is to help actors take back their voice and actually make money from their art. And she just had a beautiful baby boy. So literally, what can Tia not do? And she's just a light. She's just a breath of fresh air. You know what I mean? These people who come in and you're just like, oh yeah, I feel good around you. I feel like everything's going to be okay. And you're just amazing. She's just a wonderful soul. And I loved this conversation so much because we really went a lot of different places. And I think the overarching idea that I walked away from it with was, we live in a system of structures and institutions, and those aren't going anywhere for right now. So what can we do strategically to be working within them? And that's a question that I ask everyone. And I don't know that I actually directly asked Tia this, but I think Tia, in just the way she thinks about the world and what she's doing in the world and how she brings herself into the world, is intrinsically answering this question for us, which is just why I walked away from this conversation with so much to chew on. She talked about her experience at BMI, which is a workshop for up-and-coming lyricists and composers. And when I say workshop, like, you have to understand, it's like an institution of the musical theater industry. It's not just a workshop. It's like saying Lincoln Center is just a space where they have theater. Like, it is an institution. And she talks about a really formative experience she had there in self-advocacy and what it meant for her to really tap into her own intuition and follow her intuition, even in a space where it would be easy for her to erase that intuition or erase that connection to her intuition, or just say, you know what, I'm not going to speak up this time because I'm just going to go with the flow, which I think a lot of people can relate to a certain degree. She also talked about her experiences traveling, you know, being a performer herself. She came from an acting background, acting and singing. She's a beautiful singer. And she talked about her experiences performing on the road all across the country as a Black woman, and often being the only Black woman around. And I mean, there's a multitude of reasons for that to be an issue. But what she did with that experience was create, within Bold, her organization Bold, she created this thing called Bold on the Road that supports other Black women who are out on gigs. And she talks a lot about that. And again, it just makes me think about performers supporting other performers and how integral that is to build this community. Like, this is what we should be doing, folks, and she's doing it. We also talked about awards and award shows and why they're important. And I think a lot of times we like to hate on them. I like to hate on them. I try not to, because honestly, so many people work so hard to get there. It's no one's fault who is getting the award, right? It's just the structures behind them that kind of creep me out. And but Tia brings up several examples of why awards are so important, and why, if we are in this capitalist system that says, okay, if you're gonna win an Academy Award and or a Golden Globe or whatever, and that's all well and good, but if you aren't allowed to like get to that level of nomination or acceptance, you are not only, it's not like you're just not getting an award, you're not getting a pay bump, you're not getting a piece of the pie. There is a large pie with a lot of money, and you are being shut out of that. And Tia has some just really interesting things to say about that, and how she thinks about self-advocacy and setting boundaries. And you can just tell in this conversation how amazing she must be as a coach. Like, I just want her to tell me how to do everything. She's great. So she was an absolute joy to speak with. All of the links to find Tia, as in her lyricist and librettist work, her creative coaching, her organization Bold, all of that is in the show notes. So please just go right ahead right now, give her a follow, get in touch with her. I'm really excited for you to listen to this episode. It was my great pleasure to talk with Tia DeShazor, and I hope you love this conversation as much as I did. All right, here she is. I'm really excited to talk to you today, Tia, because you and I met a long time ago in a land far away. I don't know where, somewhere in Manhattan. And when I was researching this interview, I realized you do so much.
I do.
I think we met in the acting world when we were both actors. And yeah. Since then, like, just learning about you, I'm like, okay, she does literally everything. And one of the cool things that you do right now is that you're a lyricist and a librettist. Mm-hmm. And that is so cool. And I guess my first question before I even get into more about that, but could you tell me a little bit about like what that is? If you're going to explain it to someone who has no idea.
Yeah, a lyricist and a librettist is basically a person who writes all of the words in musical theater. So she writes the dialogue and the lyrics to every song. In opera, a librettist obviously writes all of the words because there's no dialogue usually, but generally I do musicals and I write lyrics and libretto. Yeah.
I think that's so awesome. And, you know, I'm a writer too, but I've never written in that form. And it's always interesting to me because I always think about like, oh, I can never write music, or I can never write, you know, like you're doing like a book or something for a show, because it just seems like completely I think the form of something gets in my head. I mean, you know, not that I should be doing that, but does that ever happen to you, like with certain kinds of writing, or you're like, well, I would never write this, but I can actually write a whole musical?
Yeah, Yeah, I guess it seemed daunting to me in the beginning, like the way that like writing a novel, like an epic novel would seem to me right now, which I've been reading a lot of during this time. So I feel like writing a novel would be like, where do I even begin? But for some reason, since I've been doing musicals forever and, you know, studying them even before I was doing them and just the structure of how they work, I feel like I understood it. And it, for some reason, it just didn't feel as daunting once I got started and started, you know, breaking it down what I wanted to happen. So I think just being familiar with it and having years of like doing it, like physically, I think of a lot about like when I'm writing something, I think a lot about like, what would this feel like to be on stage doing this? Does this person need to go off stage for a while? Like things like, because I've been a performer on stage, like I think about those things when I write them in, because I know how, what it's like to actually live it and be on stage. I think about like, would this even be like fun for someone to say or like sing? And those are things that I take into account because of how my acting informs it.
Yeah. And it's a form that's so physical. I mean, even if you're not necessarily in a quote unquote dance musical, there's a certain amount of, with singing and acting, there's a certain amount of stamina involved. Mm-hmm. Whereas like within film and TV, obviously you can cut and you can edit and there is also a degree of stamina involved with that, but live theater is clearly something different. So that is really fascinating to me. And I agree in terms of like when I'm writing dialogue for a scene, I have to be able to like act it out myself.
Yeah.
and then as soon as I start acting it out, I'm like, that sounds ridiculous. No, cut 80% of the words there. Yeah. You know, it's like you feel it out in your body and kind of intuit it. Yeah. How did you get started in how did you discover that that was something you wanted to even do?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I've always loved lyrics. Like looking back, I'm like, oh, all of the music I like is very lyrical. And even the pop music, the best pop music that I like is very, very lyrical. But I was sitting in an audition one day and I was reading, what was I reading? Oh no, I was listening to a podcast and it was so compelling, like the storytelling was so compelling. I was like, this needs to be a musical. It needs to be a play. Lynn Nottage needs to write this play. And then I was like, what if I like tried to write it? And then I was just like, I'm gonna write this musical. And so that was what I started writing. It's a musical about high school in inner city Chicago that experiences, you know, trauma and death by gun violence. And that's like I write a lot of comedy now. So that's just my first like thing that I wrote, but it got me into BMI. That's what I used to audition for BMI, the material from that. And so that's kind of where I found my voice and what I wanted to say, like working with different composers within BMI. Helped me kind of, you know, obviously work on my technique and also how to collaborate, because I don't at the moment write music. So that was really helpful too, to get into BMI and go through that.
Yeah. And BMI, can you just, for people who don't know what that is, just describe what that is really quickly?
Yeah. BMI, Lemon Engel Musical Theater Workshop, is a workshop that is known for churning out collaborations like, collaborations like the team who wrote Frozen and Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens and lots of great teams.
Rodgers and Hammerstein. I'm just kidding. A little too recent.
That's really funny. I wish that it was that old, but it almost, I mean, no shade, but it almost seems like it's that old. Like the way that they teach the technique is very, very traditional.
Right.
But it's a great experience because you start and you have to choose, you know, which discipline you're going to do. You're either a lyricist or a composer. They have a separate libretto workshop, but you choose a lyricist or composer. You go in and then you just get assigned a different composer to work with throughout the whole year on different songs. So you get a different song to write. Like the first song you got to write was like a subtext song. So what someone is saying, what they're actually not saying right. through a song. And then the second song was like, write a song for Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, which is like the famous BMI project. And so, so it was really cool. I learned a lot. You know, you work with people, you get to collaborate with people who like, you know, you don't work so well with, and then you get to collaborate with people who are like, please never leave me. Let's work together forever. You know? So,
I love those people. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a really great experience and you learn so much and you really, really get to dig into technique and they're very technical. And, yeah, so that was the experience where I was like, oh, I feel like because of who I was a writer before that, but I feel like that gave me more of a foundation of what kind of writer I wanted to be.
And yeah, that's so fascinating. And I guess I'm wondering, like, what made you apply to BMI? Did you always know, like, as soon as you started writing that that first musical, were you like, I know about BMI, I'm going to go there? Did someone tell you about it? How did that even get on your radar?
Yeah, I had heard about it, but I wasn't sure that I wanted to go at first. And I applied sort of like haphazardly the first time when I first started writing the early draft of what that show was. And then I didn't get in that time. And then I had worked with a composer who had gone through it and was still really involved with it. I don't remember what I was working with him on. But I told him, I was like, oh, I wrote this musical and I had a reading for it, you know, just on my own. I had like my own reading and I sent it to him and he read it and he was like, you need to do BMI. Like this, you need to do this. And I was like, really? Cause like, I hadn't thought about it, and so he was like, no, you need to do it. And he emailed them and he told them, which is interesting because, you know, sometimes you need a friend.
I would say 90% of the time you need a friend.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So he emailed them and he told them, he was like, I basically said in my email to them, if you don't let her in, you're crazy. So I was like, okay. And so then I went and I auditioned. You have to like, if you're a lyricist, you have to just go and like read your lyrics. You don't have to sing it or anything. And this was mostly like spoken word rap at this project. And I like was just auditioning in front of a room full of, you know, this all white, mostly male panel. And I like almost started crying. At that point I was like, I don't even need to get in. Like I have written something and I'm speaking it out loud. And that was the first time I was like, I'm doing this, you know, like, and then I got in and it was great. And so it's been a really good experience and we have a good relationship. Me and BMI have a good relationship, yeah. You know.
That's so cool that like it's cool to hear and it makes me kind of feel like I want to aspire to have an experience like that where it's not what you could get from that, you know, panel of all white men, like the last 5 years, right?
Yeah. Right.
Not that panel of white men. It's not what they could give to you in so far as admission, but you standing there and speaking your words and mm-hmm. affirming for yourself, yeah, I can do this. I don't need anything other than what I'm gaining from actively living in my own work.
Yeah.
Which is just such a powerful position to be in, you know? I feel like it's a powerful position to situate yourself in order to create work because it takes so much to generate something of you or through you, whether it's like an adaptation of something or not, it's still coming through you. I mean, did you feel like when you were in the BMI workshop, like, did you hit any blocks that you were like, you know, I don't know how to work through this. And if you did, was there something that you learned there that really stuck with you insofar as how to really work through something when you're just in the thick of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is where I get very candid without naming names, but because I think it's important for people to know that, like, you know, the same person that got me into BMI, we, our second year, worked together and soon realized it was not a great collaboration. And I think there was a moment where you're just like, I have to, where I was realizing that I was starting to second guess myself, you know, my, what I know to be true about what I have to say, you know? Mm-hmm. And then like the pushback that I was getting. And so I really, really, really learned in that second year, like how to articulate when I want something, because I'm very accommodating just as a person, yeah. You know, yeah. I'm very like, and as an actor too, I'll take the note. Sure. Like, I don't have to ask any questions. Like, I'll do it. And so I think, but when it comes to my words, I started to really be like, wait, but what do I really, really want to say? And how do I want to say it? And is this working? Is this the best? And it was very, very difficult to cut off that relationship in the middle of a big project, because for second year, you are, you know, preparing a bigger project. It's not just singular songs. It's like, you're working on something. And so in the middle of the year to just be like, we need to part ways and do it gracefully. And then like totally find something else to do, cause I still want to like quote unquote graduate from BMI, right. Or be promoted to advanced. So it was very, very difficult to stand in my truth and realize that the things that I'm complaining about are not crazy. And I'm not crazy. I'm not a crazy lady. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you saying that makes me feel like, well, I could cry at any moment, clearly.
Me too.
It's like 2020 into 2021, probably a little bit of 2022, right? At any moment. But it is so, I just feel like for so many people, I just like want to slow down and underline what you said of like, you convinced yourself, wait, no, I'm not crazy. Because we are always, I mean, I can only speak from a white woman's perspective because that's what I am. And I imagine, well, I know how privileged that perspective is. And from that privileged place, I know how much I accommodate. You know what I mean? And within that accommodation is like, this is like a disconnect from our instinct and intuition, because we're saying whatever I'm being told in this body of mine does not function with the outside world beyond my body. So how can I make it better for everyone else? And getting back to that, I find to be like the work of my life, you know, the work of my life for my daughter, so that I pass on as much of that like connection to intuition as I can to her. She'll have to face her own, you know, mountains for sure. But I wonder, for you, like, was that a slow process of being like, no, I need to stand in my truth. I need to reconnect to what I want to say. Or was it like a lightning bolt kind of feeling? Because I guess I'm asking because I think when people do, and I'm not saying you disconnected from your intuition, but other people who might listen to this and be like, yes, that resonates. They might not know sometimes when their intuition is speaking up. Like, if you've been disconnected for very, I used to say to a friend of mine, she'd be like, well, what does your intuition say? And I'm like, I don't have intuition. I don't know. I don't know what I want. So yeah. I guess I'm just wondering, for you and your experience in that particular moment, how did your intuition speak to you? How did you know that that's what you needed to do?
Yeah, I think it was definitely over time. It wasn't like a moment. It was, constantly having to explain myself and in ways that I felt like I shouldn't have to, you know, like, and so Yeah, I think and now I look back, and I don't know if you're familiar with like the body compass and like how.
It sounds familiar, but tell me, because I don't.
Yeah, it's like memory, like it's like, how do you tune your body compass by remembering how you felt when something was like off. So this would be the situation where I think of that moment and I remember how it felt in my body to just like be trying to collaborate with someone who's just like not down, you know, like not, yes. Not actually having a collaboration, like more wanting to tell you what to do and how that feels in my body. And so then I think of how it feels in my body, like specific places in my body where I'm feeling free and like collaborative and super, you know, we're making great art, which doesn't happen all the time and that's fine. But noticing like when, like how you feel in your body when something is not right. And, you know, so I really have begun to trust like my body compass. And whenever I have to like, you know, make a decision, which has happened more than once, leaving a composer, you know, I will say working with men composers, it's something. I trust that intuition of like, okay, what is my body actually saying and how does it feel? And like honor that. And I'm going to be okay. Like I can leave this collaboration and maybe we've lost time, but like, we will continue to lose time if we continue to work together.
Right. The time is gone no matter what. So do we want to spend time now, like finding a better, you know, collaboration or story to tell or whatever, or do we want to like double down on our sunk cost?
Yeah, for real. So, that's kind of what I lean into now when I make decisions about, especially working with people, because especially writing a musical, like it takes years. And so you want to make sure that you work well with that person, and you can even like have disagreements with them well, you know, and it doesn't have to get like, someone's being a brat, you know what I mean? Right. Or like being offended. And then I feel like I can say things as a woman and as a Black woman and not feel like I'm being a bitch, or if I could say that on your podcast, but
say whatever you want. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just like what you're saying about just like being free to express what you want to express. It's insane, right? Because we think in these like liberal spaces, which is apparently, as I do these interviews, it's like the running theme, like racism, sexism, and oppression in these liberal spaces.
Yeah, for real.
It's like you assume, not you, but people would assume, like people outside the system would maybe assume like, well, you know, the musical theater community, the Broadway community, New York City.
I did. I assumed that too.
Yeah. I mean, I did too. Yeah. And then you realize it's like, no, this is a system that our entire situation here, from making money to, I mean, that's all we're really here to do, right, in America, is to make money. But all of that is built on that. So there's not going to be a place in our society, however liberal, however progressive it is, that isn't upholding that unless you're actively working against that. Yeah. And I can imagine being in a place that is institutional in a way, like it has the traditions. And I'm not saying BMI is fostering this, but I'm just saying in cultural places that have a certain cultural standing, like, you know, like, in, yeah. It's like I've never worked at Lincoln Center, but like Lincoln Center to me is probably a place that like, it's a New York place. We love Lincoln Center. All of us Upper West Siders, we love Lincoln Center. And so I bet there's something going on in Lincoln Center that has to be rooted out if we're that like traditionally deeply connected to it. Do you know what I mean? Yes.
I mean, and this is something that like we've been talking about in Bold a lot, is like any, you know, institution that was like built really, I mean, before the civil rights movement, but even like after that, is going to definitely have some things that need to be dismantled. And that's like, that's just the reality. let's just accept it, you know? Yeah. And like, hopefully the institutions will also accept that as well.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that recently, just like, just the almost depersonalization of it. Okay, let me see if I can say this how I want to say it. So not that racism and sexism, not that these things are not like personal, but that they are so prevalent everywhere systematically that it's almost like the people that get offended by it or want to uphold something because of, you know, well, like for instance, did you see the Sharon Osbourne thing with the Cheryl Underwood thing?
Yes. I've been like really fired up about actually that for, yes, like that like consumed my week last week, unfortunately, yes. Because I like love Elaine Welteroth and so I've been watching it, which I never would have watched before. And like Amanda Kloots used to live next door to us. And so like, I was like, I'm going to start watching it. And just, yes. So continue with what you're saying. I'm on board.
Well, I mean, I would actually love to hear your thoughts on the whole thing, but I was using it as an example because I watched the clip last night because, you know, we both know Amanda from You Guys Live Next Door and from audition days and all that.
Yeah.
And so something came up on my feed about it and I was like, what happened? And I watched it and Sharon Osbourne is so defensive. Cheryl Underwood is so like gracious, not like giving so much grace, so much grace.
So calm, yeah.
And Sharon Osbourne is having a tantrum. And I'm like, dude. And I guess what I'm bringing up about that is there is this certain defensiveness. And it's like, yo, this isn't just about you. Yeah, it's about you, right? You have accountability for your words and your actions and who you support. But we also live in a society where it's impossible to just like we have to do so much work in revamping the entire system that like you can't pretend you don't live in a racist system. Like,
yeah,
that's just what it is. And like you, and what you were saying of like, it is what it is. So let's start there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so many thoughts about that, but I think with Sharon, I just feel I watched her even before this incident kind of dismiss when anyone would bring up race, you know, and so, which is easy for her to do, which is like, it's kind of easy for her to do because she doesn't have to acknowledge it, you know, it doesn't affect her in that way. But I also, at that point, in that moment, when she did that, I was like, oh, this can't happen. Like, this is not a safe environment to have this conversation for these two Black women on the show. Like,
yes,
this has got to be addressed. Like, there needs to be diversity training. Like, what, like, because I also don't want the world to see this.
Yes.
And I also like, as graceful and Cheryl, as Cheryl was and Elaine, I was just like, I wish that they didn't have to be that way. Like, I wish that they could have been like, you're not going to talk to me like that. Like, you know, which would like, then they would have been like the aggressive, you know, person, you know?
Yes. And it's impossible, right? I have not obviously ever been in that position, but it would, to me, it would feel impossible because what do you, and again, kind of like what we're talking about before about your intuition, like your intuition says, Sharon, STFU, my friend, you don't know what you're talking about. You're making a fool of yourself. And also like, this is how it goes. Like if someone, I mean, I could go on and on and I don't want to go totally derailed about Sharon Osbourne because she's not worth the time and attention, but it did infuriate me actually how the two Black women on the set held that space because like you said, that doesn't feel safe for them to hold the space and hold the composure and hold the, like just like create a safe space for Sharon Osbourne to have a temper tantrum about a guy who's like clearly racist. Like, relax. Yeah, your friend's racist. Okay. And like, maybe you are too. Okay. Like, start from there. Yeah.
I've been thinking that for a while, just because, and not to keep going on it, but like, I've been watching Elaine try to bring the other white people into the conversation, because I think, you know, like on a show like that, when it's the subject of race, it's expected for the Black person to talk about it. But what really needs to happen is for the white people on the show to be like, this is what needs to stop, because it's like,
yes.
And so that's what's been frustrating for me to watch. And like, because I've been in spaces like that, and I, you know, even in like any, you know, predominantly white institution, I've been in this situation, you know? And so I've watched people say nothing and then me have to say something and then be the person who's like all sensitive, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. I have like chills up and down my body, because it's just, it rings so true. And as someone who, like, from my perspective, can only see it, like, I know that it's true. And I don't need to know that it's true. If someone is saying it's true, and it's their experience, then that's what is happening. And I think that is why Bold is such a cool initiative and organization that you built. And I just looking into it, I just thought, like, what a powerful way to connect people and to create these safe spaces and to like really, you know, externalize change. And so could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Bold was started, I think 5 or 6 years ago, I'm foggy, but it's an organization for Black women in the performing arts. And we exist to, because we believe that Black women will change the world, and we exist to contribute creatively to the telling of our stories. This is our mission statement, and to cultivate wholehearted for one another community. And so what that means is that we create community among Black women in the performing arts, and we create work for each other. So I started with my friend Destiny. We met in an audition, we met in a callback of like 40 people for one role for a Black woman, right? And so there's all these Black women in this tidy room together, like we just danced. And so we're all talking, but like everyone's helping each other and like being friendly and having a great time. And there wasn't that competitive energy. Maybe some people had it, but like the vibe was really great. And so we were like, we need to make something of this. And so we're like, this is what happens when Black women get together. Like, we help each other. Like, we're on each other's side. And so that's how it came about. And it's been really great to sort of be kind of a movement for like what that's kind of sisterhood means within this industry, because there is so much competition. Like I'm saying, like there's like one role, you know, and you see this, the same people auditioning for the same one role as you. And so we really just try to break down that scarcity mentality and come together as a community and celebrate our wins and celebrate what it's like to just be us in the performing arts.
I think that's beautiful. And also, even if there were 17 roles for Black women in a show, it would still be like the most competitive industry ever.
For real. But
add on top of that there's like one in the show. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Bold on the Road, is that, can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I'm actually quite fascinated about that facet of the program.
Yeah. Bold on the Road, it grew out of like the first year that we were an organization, because there were so many people that were on the road, whether it was at a regional theater or on tour. Mm-hmm. And it was also at a time where like there was an uprising in, you know, I think it was maybe 2016 or 2018, mm-hmm. another uprising, you know, people being killed, but then also what that means for you when you're on the road with a predominantly white cast, predominantly white producing team, you know, creative team, whatever, and you don't feel supported. You might experience people were experiencing racism, you know, in these small towns that they're in, performing in, and not really feeling supported, or like people don't know how to talk about it. And so we had a private Facebook group and people were saying like, I'm experiencing this out here in Idaho or wherever I was. Right. And we would send them care packages. We would send them, you know, just, you know, love. We would set up like Zoom dates. Someone would be on a cruise ship or whatever. We'd set up like Zoom dates where we'd get to talk through things. And before Zoom was as cool as it is now. And we would talk through things and just like show each other support. We would have like drives for people to bring things to put in the care packages that we would send out along the road. So I think it, you know, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think as things start again, that's going to be something that needs to be focused on because of the way the world is right now, you know?
Yeah.
And if people are so much more bold, you know, about their racism, if you are in their small town and they don't know who you are. Yes. And I've been in not even small towns where I've been the only Black woman in a company, and I felt extremely isolated and unsafe, and you know, and it's a really difficult concept to explain, but you need that sisterhood, because people don't know how to, you know, again, predominantly white institutions don't know how to address it, even if you bring it up.
Yeah, and also I don't think like white folks are still learning, and I should say unlearning a lot of stuff, you know? So I think even, you know, I can imagine some of the things that I have said before in thinking like it would be helpful or like, I'm trying to be supportive. Like I can imagine like Courtney, okay, no, that's not helpful. Not helpful. Love you. Thank you. No, you know, like there is something to be said about, you know, when people are in, I guess like thinking about isolation this year and how isolated we've all been, there's something, I'm not equating the two at all, but just thinking about the larger concept of isolation, mm-hmm. someone just being able to see you and like not need to fix it and not need to change it. I mean, yes, please do. But like knowing that it might be enough in this moment for someone to know exactly how I'm feeling and not have to have me explain it to them. You know, I can imagine that being really powerful.
Yeah. And it's not, it's interesting because I've never worked at a theater where I did not have an issue having to do with race, whether it's like with my hair, it's usually with my hair, or with my, you know, tights, not matching my body, something that's just like not right. And, but nobody else really cares. It's that much more difficult if you're the only one or like,
right.
one of, you know, actually the experience that I had, the last time I was away, kind of, put into play what we do with Actors Equity. We're on the EEOC committee and we do events for them every February and other times of the year too, not just February. But we do a lot with them and help inform policy that can change things like that, because it's like those little microaggressions that like can really impact your time at a theater and nobody will usually know. And I think there are older generations who just like sucked it up and got over it. And I can't do that. I don't have that gene.
No. And you know what? It's like none of us, whether we are, you know, white folks or BIPOC or whatever, like none of us should want that. Why do any of us want to live in that world?
Yeah.
Why do any of us want to live in a world that would make anyone feel uncomfortable or isolated, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's, that's always what's confusing to me too, not to go back to Sharon Osbourne, but like, why do you want to live in that world that you have to like defend? Like why is that the thing that must not end? Or like, it just seems so silly. I mean, not silly, like racist, you know, but Okay, so I feel like this question is a completely unfair question. I ask most podcast guests this question because I'm interested in all the answers that could come from it. So what do you feel or perceive to be the pathways to instigate change from inside the system, whether it's theater or, musical theater writing or, any of these systems or institutions that we're a part of? Not to say like, hey, Tia, what's the answer to dismantling racism? Go. But what do you think the pathways are for us to journey down?
Yeah, I think that it has to be both structural and personal. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why I like I do so many things. Like with Bold, that's like, we work within structures a lot. We have partnerships with MCC, New York Theater Workshop, The Public, where we do programs with them, Signature Theater, where we like make sure not just like Black women are getting in seats and like being in the audience, but that Black women are being in the spaces behind the scenes, that they're feeling like they could have their work on those stages and having their work on those stages and being on those stages. So the work that we get to do with those theaters and, through Actors Equity, where we make changes in policy, that's super important. But I also, there's only so much that we can do as long as these institutions stay predominantly white. And because I think it has to go beyond diversity and inclusion, right? Like there has to be a dismantling of white supremacist practices. And so that's where my coaching comes in, because that's where I feel like there has to be personal boundaries that you have to set for yourself, so that when you're in a place of influence, when you are, as a writer getting your show on Broadway, you will say, no, we're not doing 10 out of 12s, or no, I won't put all celebrities in my show, or where you draw the line, or no, this workday doesn't have to be this long, it's ridiculous, or no, I won't have 8 shows a week, yeah. No, I won't uphold the slave, system of work in this country. Like there's there's a lot of dismantling that needs to be done, and it doesn't have to be like huge and groundbreaking. It could just be like one thing at a time, where you're like, actually, I'm not going to uphold perfectionism anymore. I'm going to have a space that's collaborative, where people are heard. So when I have a rehearsal, that's what we do, I think there are structural things and policy things, but I think as artists, we have to say no to things. Like yes. We have to just be like, this is not it anymore. We have to, and believe that like that can be, accepted, or maybe not accepted is the word I'm looking for, but that will be enough. That will be enough, that your work is good enough to hold that up. And
yes.
Yes.
It's really interesting. You're bringing up the whole idea about like, no, I'm going to make this a collaborative environment, because just briefly, this podcast came out of me wanting to break down the behind the scenes of how I made my first film, Screen Test. And it was just a short film, 14-minute film. And I wrote it and directed it and produced it. And when I was putting it all together, people, you just start something and then all of a sudden the right person walks into your line of sight and you're like, oh, we connect, we're going to do this. Like all of a sudden, like this little pathway opens up. Right. And so there were all of these really great moments that kind of led to our day on set, where like just the right people, the right energy, the right feel. And I walked onto set as a director and was like, okay, I've never directed before. I am not the smartest person in the room. By leagues and bounds, I'm not the smartest person in the room. So what I'm going to do is, and I had to like really give myself the pep talk, I'm going to be incredibly confident. No one is going to worry when they're in my presence, so that I can create space for people to tell me what I don't know and to collaborate with me. And one of my best friends who helped produce, she was one of the producers on it, and she also did the wardrobe. She works a lot in branded content, and she works a lot with a lot of men. And this isn't a blanket statement about men at all, but about the institution, right, of perfectionism. And
I get to say what perfect is.
Yeah. And I get to, and don't come at me with any suggestions and like, yeah. Cool. She said it was such a different feel than she was used to, because it was a collaborative environment. And I remember thinking to myself that day, like when she said it, I was like, is that bad? Am I supposed to be something else? And I was like, well, Court, like, that's not you. Like, that's not you. You're producing it. You're putting your money into it. So if ever you have an opportunity to do it your way, this is the day to do it, you know? But it's interesting that, like, even when we're, you know, you're talking about the personal change that we have to create, like, just when you're in a position of quote unquote power or decision making, mm-hmm. even then you're going to have that battle with your intuition of like, can I do this? Can I enact? Maybe I'm not thinking I'm enacting change, but like, can I follow my gut instinct, even though it goes against every institutionalized idea of good?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like, and that's why, like, I created that program kind of for myself. It's one of my courses called Infinite Influence, and it's about like deciding now what you will do and what you won't do.
Yes.
And like, because then when you get into the space, right, when you have the producers breathing down your neck, telling you that things need to be done this way, because that's all the way that they've always been done, then you already have that boundary for yourself where you're like, nope, you know. And so I use this example of Michaela Cole a lot, because she just is super groundbreaking. And I don't know if you read her article in Vulture where she asked Netflix, when she was making I May Destroy You, she asked them for 5% of the rights to it. And they were like, you know, that's not really how things are done. It's not a big deal. And she's like, well, if it's not a big deal, then can I have 5% of the rights? And she's like, they're like, no. She's like, what about 2? What about 0.5%? And they were like, no. But then the woman was like, what you're doing is good, or something like that. I'll run it up the chain. She couldn't do it. And so, and her agents pressured her to take the Netflix deal anyway. And she ended up leaving her agency and then going to HBO, where she made I May Destroy You, and got her rights, you know? And so it's like,
so good.
But it wouldn't have happened if she hadn't, nobody gets their rights. No, it doesn't happen. Like, but it wouldn't have happened if she's like, no, like, and maybe she learned it from the previous thing that she did, but she really was like, this is what I feel like is fair and what I want. And so I'm going to ask for it until I get it. Somebody's going to give it to me, you know? And so, or I'll give it to myself somehow. I don't know. I'm imagining she's saying this to herself, but it's so groundbreaking that, in this small way, she was like, I want to make some sort of change that's going to like, not just affect me, but I feel like it will affect it will affect change in the way that people get their work produced and put on TV, you know?
100%. And didn't Issa Rae have something like a story like that too, where I should probably Google this before I say it out loud, but I thought there was something where they wanted someone else to play the role. And she was like, no. Mm-mm.
That's so true, because I don't remember hearing that, but it sounds right. Because if you think about it, like, there's nobody like Issa Rae. Like, you couldn't put her, like, you couldn't type her if you tried, right? She's just her. And so I could see how producers or would look at her and be like, I don't know how you fit into the, you know, into this, you know what I mean? Because of the way that we put people into types and boxes and things like that.
Right. Or like, oh, I get, I'm using air quotes for the podcast. I get a black woman. Let's use my white idea of, and it's like, she's right there. She wrote it. It's about her. She became known to you by performing said role.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I think, yeah, you're right. It, and it's, and a lot of times it feels, I think it can feel like, am I asking for too much? Am I being like, oh no, put me in the role? You know, I've thought about that sometimes as far as like writing my own material and acting in it. And I haven't really done that, but I've just had that inner monologue of like, if I'm in it, is that selfish? Am I right? And it's like, you know, whether that those projects were right or not for me to do, I'm just saying in general, it's like, we're already going to have that inner dialogue of,
of,
am I too much? Is this too much? Is what I'm saying too bold, too forward? And yeah. And so it is really powerful to have those like concrete examples of women who have done it. They've said, okay, I'm gonna be quote unquote too much for these people.
Yeah.
By being myself.
Oh, it makes me so excited. Like me just makes me so excited. When I read that, I was like screaming. I mean, the whole article is like in so great. But it's, she's such an inspiration because I feel like she's who she is, you know? And she's, and people can take her and leave her, you know? And then, but then they take her and like, but then she's like, yes, I know that I'm like nothing you've ever seen. And I also want 5% of the rights. You know what I mean? Like,
and so. Also I'm going to be shut out of the Golden Globes.
Right. Yes. Oh yes. Yeah. That too.
I mean, and we, and like, I know we're kind of like winding down and everything, but I do kind of want to talk about, like, I wanted your perspective on awards because I watched your IG live. I think it was for your coaching. So like, let's just hold on for a second, folks. We're listening to this. We're talking to Tia. She is an actor. She is a lyricist librettist. She created Bold and yes, she's a coach. So I think it was for one of your coaching videos. You were talking about like awards are important. And I don't want to say it. Can you talk about why awards are important, especially for people who are like, well, screw it. Just like,
And I think artists like to kind of like downplay how important they are. And I get that. I totally get that because, you know, art is art and it's beautiful and it should come from a place of, you know, beauty or whatever, and not thinking about like what you'll get from it. Yeah. And that's true. But it also, like, awards matter because they can put you in a different place financially. And so when you have something like I May Destroy You shut out of the Golden Globes, or even Lovecraft Country shut out of the Golden Globes, then you get something like Emily in Paris, who's like, it didn't even have like that much of a, I enjoyed watching Emily in Paris. I've liked that kind of stuff too, but did not have a cultural impact in the way that these two shows did. You have them getting shut out and you're like, wow, how? Like, who is doing this? And I had had this discussion and thinking everyone was outraged. And then you would have people say, well, you know, we see us, like Black people, we see each other. I was like, I get that and it's wonderful. And I get that it's art, but also like, this is a barrier to pay equity. Like, because when you get even a nomination, you're on another level as how much they can pay you, or how much they are willing to pay you, for how much you can negotiate, because you can say, someone thought that I deserved a nomination. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, it's so much more than just like some frivolous thing. Right. It does just put you in a different bracket. So, you know, shows like Emily in Paris, who I found out they actually flew the the people on that committee to Paris and like wined and dined them, you know, and yeah. really wooed them. And that's how they got, you know, a Golden Globe nomination. And it's important to like really look into these practices because they're barriers to equity and parity, you know? So, and it's really easy to just be like, I don't, you know, but it's important to just go deeper and be like, actually, this is why there's such a huge pay gap.
And if we live in a capitalist system that is going to award you for how much money you bring in, or we're going to play this capitalist game, mm-hmm. then award shows and pay equity is even more important because you're playing within the game, the structures of the game. We wish the game was different. It is not different. It is what it is. So how can we create more equality and equity within that game and that system?
Yeah. And it also is really easy to just be like, oh, like we're starving artists and we're used to, there's a starving artist mentality that, but we aren't. The arts industry is an over $800 billion industry. That's the case, and in New York City alone, it's over $120 billion.
Yes.
So if that's the case, then there needs to be, you know, more equity and yeah.
Yes. Thank you for the stats because
I have to memorize these numbers because I hear it so much from people being like, well, there's no money. And I'm like, actually,
well, exactly. There is money. And that's the thing that's infuriating. And there's absolutely money in the arts. There's like Broadway brings in like whatever, I forget what the statistic is, but it's a huge percentage. Of the city's, I'm going to say GDP, but that sounds like it's national.
It contributes to the economy.
Yeah. It's a huge part of it. And so when people are saying things like to Michaela Cole or to whoever, right? Or like, well, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Well, then it's not that big of a deal. Then pay me. There is money to be had. And it's, you know, when people are saying like, well, why? I can imagine someone saying, well, why does she want, it's a she, right? Whoever we're talking about. Why does she want so much money? Mm. And it's like, because there's so much money and she wants the proper percentage.
Yeah.
Why are you defending the producer that you don't even know their name? They didn't even work on, or maybe they did work on, maybe they worked very hard on it. Maybe they worked the exact same amount on it as this actor or this writer. And why are they getting 500% to 1%, like whatever the ratio is, 500 to 1 or something, more money? Like if the money is there, then the money is there. And this is where I think people are like, you know, now we could really go down the rabbit hole of like our internalized stuff in this country.
Scarcity mentality, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And all of that. And so, whew, good on you for creating coaching about that, because I can barely get my own thoughts out, let alone help anyone.
I mean, it's really for myself and like what I bring into negotiations, you know, when, you know, people want you to write things for like nothing.
Yes.
I'm not down with that, you know. Yes. It takes time and energy and creativity, especially if it's a commission, you know, I have to really believe that like, you have money and we're going to make this work for both of us. I'm not asking you for something crazy. And I'm also bringing something. Like, I think a lot of artists forget that they're like bringing, like they're bringing something to the table. Like they should be compensated well, you know?
Yes. So it's work, you know? And people are like, well, it's my passion. And it's like, well, there are lots of people who are passionate about lots of things that they do for money, for work.
Lots of money.
This is one of them. Okay. Well, let's like round this out so you can go enjoy your weekend and your life. I want to just ask one final question to end on a happy high note. This has been such a great conversation and I really loved talking to you. Where do you find joy?
Oh man, it's funny because I find joy in a lot of things that I can't have right now, like being on, like traveling and being on a beach. But really, like being with my husband, being with CK right now, like it has been like, that's where I've been finding joy. Like we laugh all day. We don't get tired of each other. Like we just laugh all day about our stupid inside jokes. Nobody else, I try to explain it when people are over and like nobody else gets it. But really like it's been the one thing, and I keep, you know, as you may remember, like he's been away a lot in our marriage. And so this is finally, like, I keep thanking him, like, I'm so glad you're here. Like, it's so weird, but I'm like, I'm so glad you're here, you know, because yes. I'm finding joy in like new ways with just like being with him. And so that's where I've been finding joy. I mean, I'll be happy when I can like go out to cafes and sip a tea. That's another way that I do that and collaborate in person with people anymore. I mean, again, but right now it's just like hanging out with him.
Love that. And he is such a joyful, beautiful, wonderful person.
Like, he really is. I mean, a lot of times people talk poorly about their husbands, but he really is great.
No, he is great. He is great. I just for people on the podcast who wouldn't know, CK and I did a show together so long ago, very long ago. And he's an incredible tap dancer and artist, actor, human being, singer, all of that. Well, I love what you said about him and about saying like, I'm so glad you're here. Cause I feel like that is just, that feels like good in my heart. Like I'm just like to know, like, I'm so glad you're here. I feel like that's 2021 for all of us. Like we're just here, we're here, you know? And Tia, I'm so glad you're here. This is great.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.
And that was Tia DeShazor. If you haven't followed her already, you can find her in the link in the show notes. And the last thing I'm going to ask you to do is if you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review The Break Breakdown on Apple Podcasts. Or if that's not your jam, just share it on social. That's also a great way to help spread the word about the amazing work that all of these independent artists are doing. And thank you for being here. It means so very much to me. And I'll talk to you soon.